Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the gyms in the BC. It is Saturday, the 7th of December, Anno Domini 2013. And you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Woden.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, on this day, we remember the attack on Pearl Harbor. We're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Let's start with the news. Hackers.
Those silly hackers.
You know immediately when I start any news story with the word hackers, it's not going to be good. Hackers have stolen usernames and passwords for nearly 2 million accounts on Facebook, Google, Twitter, Yahoo, and others. The massive data breach was a result of keylogging software maliciously installed on an untold number of computers around the world. The virus was capturing login credentials for key websites over the past month and sending those usernames and passwords to a server controlled by the hackers. On November 24th, TrustWave researchers tracked down that server located in the Netherlands. They discovered compromised credentials for more than 93,000 websites, including Facebook, Gmail, Google, Plus, YouTube, Yahoo, Twitter, Odnoklassniki, a Russian social network, ADP, and LinkedIn accounts. ADP, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Yahoo have said they've notified and reset passwords for compromised users. Google declined to comment. Among the compromised data are 41,000 credentials used to connect FTP and 6,000 remote logins. The hacking campaign started secretly collecting passwords on October 21st, and it might be ongoing. Although TrustWave Security discovered the Netherlands proxy server, they said that there are several other similar servers that they haven't tracked down yet. Want to know whether or not your computer is affected? Just searching programs and files won't be enough because the virus running in the background is hidden. Your best bet is to update your antivirus software and download the latest patches for internet browsers, Adobe, and Java. Obviously, this is mostly affecting Windows users.
And if your antivirus won't update, that's a good indication you are infected.
Exactly. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. I've changed my passwords again. And the choices are, yep, getting tired of it too. Yep, but I don't mind. Nope, I'm sure I'm safe. And nope, I'm an idiot. And so far we have 26 votes. You're very harsh on yourself since the leading choice is nope, I'm an idiot. But at least you know you are, and that's what's important. Now I know you're going to have more to say about this because you are who you are. So if you slide down the right-hand column to fascinating stuff, you'll see a link to the forums, and you'll be able to check out the forum link under poll discussion. You'll see a forum link for 7 December 2013, constant breaches in online systems. So far we've only got a few responses, so log in and make yourself heard. And of course, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Just like James did from Rochester, New York. Welcome, James. What's your question?
Windows Live Mail, and on the bottom where it says, way on the bottom, it says working online, and then next to it, it says updating calendar, and that keeps flickering. Do you know anything about that?
Does your calendar ever update?
I don't really use the calendar, but this thing keeps every 1 second, you know, it's like popping up, flickering.
Yeah, it's not really anything to worry about. What it's saying is that it's constantly checking your calendar in case someone has added an event or whatever, because among the things that you can do with the calendar on any of these systems is, for example, set a meeting with someone else.
I don't really use it. I never noticed the flickering before.
Well, it doesn't matter if you don't use it. It's there and can be used. So it's one of those things where even if you ignore it, it's still there working.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things they can do is the calendar program can scan your email as it comes in. And if someone sends you, you know, let's do lunch tomorrow, the calendar can read lunch tomorrow and make an appointment for you at noon tomorrow.
Oh, maybe I'll start using it.
So it's kind of neat what it can do, but it sounds like that's what it might be trying to do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It doesn't sound, I mean, it's not a problem.
Okay, yeah, as long as it's not a problem. It never used to flicker like that before.
You may not have noticed it.
Also, on my Yahoo homepage, you know, you can set it up, and it's got, like, my inbox for the Yahoo-type mail, and it's sometimes it's there, and other times it just says loading, and, like, the TV listings loading and updating.
Yeah, that's the other end. That has nothing to do with you. I mean, it might be that your system is a little slow. That's a possibility.
Uh-huh.
Your network is a little slow, but it's more likely their end. There's a lot of stuff nowadays, because we do so many things on the web.
Yeah,
we're dependent on how fast the servers are at the other end,
uh-huh.
And often enough, with so many people doing so much stuff, they sometimes slow down a little.
Okay, I just didn't want to make sure it was okay.
Yeah, that's not yours. There's nothing you can do about that. So,
okay, thank you.
I guess it's okay.
Bye-bye.
And every time Yahoo changes their front page, things look different and move around, and it's very frustrating for people because it doesn't work the way it used to.
Right. But yeah, the we see it all the time. There are times during the day, for example, when a whole bunch of people were complaining the other day that Google Plus was very, very slow. And why? We don't know, but it was for everybody. It wasn't it wasn't anything that anybody did. It wasn't anything that anybody had to deal with, because it was at the other end.
Yeah,
you know, just an influx of too many people doing too much stuff all at once.
So one thing he can try, James, is log out of your live mail session and then log back in again. I'm seeing a couple of suggestions that it's trying to connect to your calendar service and can't, so that's why it keeps saying updating.
Maybe.
So a lot of times when people finish reading their web mail, they just close the window without actually logging off, which can be dangerous because that means someone could come up after you and reopen that window again. So generally, you always want to log out of your bank account, your Amazon account, your mail account, whatever you're logged into. Log out before you close the window.
Right. And as you can see, it's taking me for freaking ever to log into here to my Google Drive account. Luckily, I'm already in the Hangout, so that's not really much of a problem.
It's one of the sort of catch-22s that once a service becomes popular, it gets busy, and they have to add more hardware at the other end to keep track and handle how much busier it's getting. And sometimes there's a delay between how much hardware they add and how busy they've gotten.
Right. It's not that they don't want to handle everybody's requests. They just can't.
Yep.
They don't have, you know, racks of servers just sitting around waiting to be turned on and thrown into the mix.
Yeah. I'm actually surprised by how few simultaneous connections it takes to bring down some sites. I listen to a lot of the shows on the This Week in Tech Network, and he says they have, you know, a couple of thousand live listeners in their live stream, and they'll mention a website, and within seconds, it's down.
Yep.
So say 2,000 people are listening. How many, maybe half of those might go to a website? So 1,000 simultaneous requests will take the average site down? Now, I'm sure big sites like Amazon and Google can take tens of thousands of requests
per
second.
Then multiply that by /dot.
Yep.
There's something called the /dot effect. They show a website and it goes down because, in yep. this case, millions of people
yeah.
instantly go to it. there are people who apparently just sit on Slashdot waiting to see whatever the next cool thing is.
Although it is kind of a point of pride that if your article gets Slashdotted, you were important for that 10 milliseconds.
I told you I had a server get Slashdotted once, didn't
yep.
I?
Yeah.
The little handheld Linux PDA that I actually set up on the web with a web browser and a small version of MySQL. And it was designed just for me to play with, just to test, just to prove I could do it. And a friend of mine Slashdotted me. But yeah, back to this business with the passwords. Look, if what happened was there was a worm. There was a worm out on the internet that was basically just a Windows worm. So Mac and Linux people are and Google and Chromebook and Android and whatever people are fairly secure. But the issue is that millions of accounts were hit. And so you might want to take a moment to quietly change your password.
Well, you should run an antivirus scan first, because what a keylogger is it watches every key you type and logs it. So you go to google.com, type in your email address and your password. They have logged that email address and password. So if you go back there and change your password, the logger will still change the password. It will capture your new password. So first thing you have to do is clear that malware from your computer before you change your password, because then the malware will know that you changed it and pass that back up to the bad guys.
Right. All right, back to our callers. Our next person, Rick, from Irondequoit, New York. Welcome, Rick. What's up?
Hello, guys. Merry Christmas, maybe.
You too.
If I don't talk to you before then. Got a quick question on software or uninstalling some software updates in the computer. These Microsoft.NET framework type files, I have like a bunch that are 0.20 and then 4, and they say client profile, client or extension. And some other services and things like that. I didn't know if those can be deleted to make some more room.
Well, here's the issue with .NET frameworks. Microsoft has created the .NET system as a programming backend, right? So a lot of people have written .NET code. So often when you run a utility or in fact, parts of Internet Explorer and Word, the whole Office suite, require a .NET framework in the background.
Okay.
The problem is there are multiple .NET frameworks. Theoretically, you could get rid of all but the latest one.
That's what I was trying to figure out.
However, many of the utility-type programs that have been created do not update. So if they require version 2 of the .NET framework, then really, if you get rid of it, they stop working.
And the next time you launch it, it will give you a .NET error and need to reinstall that .NET framework.
Right.
If you're running out of space...
So, I mean, even if I tried it and went back, I may get rid of one version, we'll say, that I'm not using at this point.
But you might end up needing to reinstall it later. And look,
you don't know you're using it.
They're not taking that much space on your hard drive, and unless you're honestly out of space on your hard drive,
you're better off buying a new hard drive.
Yeah. Actually, this is a computer that I work with at work that we're trying to run a lot of things on it and different stuff and just trying to make some room. And an idea was maybe to get rid of some of those.
Yeah,
Just delete them, but you may find that something doesn't run anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. You find a terabyte hard drive for $100 and replace it.
Yeah, that's true too. Okay, well, you answered my question. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, we find that happens a lot. People are looking around and seeing what's in their machines. And if they have an issue with the amount of data they've got on their hard drives, you can also just add a second hard drive. If, for example, your You've got a lot of stuff running, but it's gathering data, or you need a lot of data to run it, or a lot of big files to run it. Put them on a second drive, and you'll be better off, because that second drive can be fairly large, and it can also speed up your machine.
And that's easier than replacing your main drive.
Right, right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Odom, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Sound Bites on Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Odom.
And at 25 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites.
Ooh, it's 12:25. But it's not 12:25 on 12:25.
Okay, moving right along.
How many days till Christmas?
Yeah. I'm sure there's got to be somewhere on the net that will tell you that immediately. Computer scientists have proposed a malware prototype that uses inaudible audio signals to communicate, a capability that allows the malware to covertly transmit keystrokes and other sensitive data even when infected machines have no network connection. The proof-of-concept software, or malicious Trojans that adopt the same high-frequency communication methods, could prove especially adept in penetrating highly sensitive environments that routinely place an air gap between computers and the outside world. Using nothing more than the built-in microphones and speakers of standard computers, the researchers were able to transmit passwords and other small amounts of data from distances of almost 65 feet. The software can transfer data at much greater distances by employing an acoustical mesh network made up of attacker-controlled devices that repeat the audio. The researchers from Germany's Fraunhofer Institute for Communication, Information Processing, and Ergonomics, which is probably one word in German, recently disclosed their findings in a paper published in the Journal of Communications. It came a few weeks after a security researcher said his computers were infected with a mysterious piece of malware that used high-frequency transmissions to jump air gaps. The new research neither confirms nor disproves Drago Ruiz's claim, that's the researcher, of the so-called bad BIOS infections, but it does show that high-frequency networking is easily within the grasp of today's malware. The researchers developed several ways to use inaudible sounds to transmit data between two Lenovo T400 laptops using only their built-in microphones and speakers. The most effective technique relied on software originally developed to acoustically transmit data underwater, created by the Research Department of the Underwater Acoustics and Geophysics in Germany. The so-called Adaptive Communication System, or ACS modem, was able to transmit data between laptops as much as 65 feet apart. By chaining additional devices that pick up the signal and repeat it to other nearby devices, the mesh network can overcome much greater distances. The ACS modem provided better reliability than other techniques that were also able to use only the laptop speaker and microphones to communicate. Still, it came with one significant drawback, a transmission rate of about 20 bits per second, a tiny fraction of the standard network connection. The paltry bandwidth forecloses the ability of transmitting video or any other kinds of data with large file sizes. The researchers said attackers could overcome that shortcoming by equipping the Trojan with functions that transmit only certain types of data, such as login credentials captured from a keylogger or a memory dumper. So, getting worried about that slick new laptop with the high-end audio? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
So we've had apps that do that for a couple of years now on Android and iOS. There's one called Chirp that we used to play with. You run it on both ends, and you send a file, and it plays audio out of the speaker, and then the microphone of the other device picks it up, and you get the file. We even I heard about it on a This Week in Tech show. They played the audio on the show. It came through the speakers on the computer, and I got the file after the fact. So I just played the audio file of the podcast, and I still get the file.
Yeah.
So that's neat when it works the way you want it to.
Until it's a virus.
Right. Someone turns the purpose for evil.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Of course they do, and that's what they do every time. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Ed from Canandaigua, New York. Welcome, Ed. What's up?
Hey, Nick. How you doing? It's a good show today.
Thank you.
Last week at the end of your show, there was a an elder techie like myself who called and was complaining about his email app.
Yeah.
That he was able to get to it on his cell phone and it, no problem, but the minute he sat down at the laptop, it gave him an error message about not identifying his password. Well, it took me a day or two to figure it out a month or so ago, and I chuckle every time I hear it. But us old guys that are just picking up smartphones for the first time, when they sit down at the desktop and they get that error, check your cell phone, because if you're signed in on your cell phone, you're not going to get in on the laptop.
Yeah, some mail services don't let you sign in multiple locations.
Yeah,
so if you're
exactly
right,
and I'll bet that's listening to him. He was, you know, in a similar situation.
Right.
With equipment and applications and so forth, and yep. I'm thinking, boy, that's got to happen to a lot of people.
That's a very good thought. That's a very good thought.
I've even seen that message with even LAN providers, Time Warner and Frontier, that what we see people do is on their phone, on their computer, on their tablet, they tell it to get mail every 5 minutes. Because they never want to miss a message. So that means when your computer's getting mail, your phone can't. And when your tablet's getting mail, your computer can't, because it won't let you check that often. It should get a better error message than password wrong. That's why I was talking to Nick before the show, too. That's got to be the last error message in the list. And if it can't find the right one, it just shows that one.
Well, especially for us older guys, you know, we didn't grow up with all this stuff, so.
Yep. Yeah, right. But I think you're right. And, of course, nowadays, most of the younger folks that I know only use their phones for everything.
Yep. Yep.
But I would suspect that happens more with Pop than it does with IMAP.
Yeah, IMAP is sort of designed to be like that.
Right.
But Pop, yeah, so I see it a lot with Roadrunner, which only uses Pop. But the error message comes up that, I forget the exact wording, but it's you can't log in because you're already logged in.
Yeah, and of course, with Pop, a Pop server, the mail is downloaded to your machine. With an IMAP server, it stays on the server. So if you're looking at your mail on multiple devices, you absolutely want to use IMAP, because otherwise some of your mail's on one device, some of it's on another device, and you don't see everything in one place.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right, excellent thought. Thanks, Ed.
All right, take care.
You too.
Yep.
That's a very good thought. We often tend to forget that not everybody is doing things exactly the way we are. I use Gmail, so it's IMAP.
Mm-hmm.
So I get exactly the same email everywhere, and
everywhere,
I probably see it on 10 different devices. But
and if you are using Roadrunner, they don't support IMAP, so you can't do this. But what a lot of people have done is make a Gmail account and tell Gmail to pick up your Roadrunner mail. Then you can synchronize your mail between your phone, your tablet, and your computer through Gmail and just sort of ignore the Roadrunner server. You can still use your Roadrunner address, but you don't have to get your mail from Roadrunner directly.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Brian from Parenton, New York. Welcome, Brian. What's up?
How are you doing? Pavilion, actually.
Oh, Pavilion. My fault.
I read Avalon.
I clearly need better glasses. It's all about me.
or younger eyes. If that's possible.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, wouldn't it? Two things, actually. I picked up a Toshiba laptop satellite from a garage sale early on in the winter. And one thing I got to stress, and I know I preach it to the choir, when I picked this thing up, it just had a simple rootkit in it, but the guy thought the hard drive had failed. So I got it running with this hard drive on there. Take them out when you sell them to people. If I was not a straight shooter, I would have been.
Or at least erase your data. Nuke the data.
It's like, okay, I had this thing running like in 5 minutes. And I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, but all his data were on there, weren't they?
But if you think the hard drive is dead, you're not going to know how. But we've heard about people dumpster diving behind a business, and you find 10 computers that they threw out, and all the data is still on it.
It's insane. But anyway, that's cool. But I rest assured, I deleted it. I did a Dan Ban on it.
Good.
But anyway, a question, something I can't find, a problem I've had, I can't find on Google or any of the resources on the internet, which is odd. I bought a copy of Windows 8 to put on this laptop after I got it running, because I just wanted to try it out.
Sure.
And, I can't get any of the function keys to work. And also, the virtual power button won't turn Windows off or on. I have to use the physical button on it. And I was wondering if you guys knew if 8 was doing any sort of housekeeping during shutdown, you know, during a hard shutdown as opposed to a software shutdown.
Right. What model laptop is this again?
Yeah, I'd have to go look at it. It's a relatively newer Toshiba satellite. It's in the L series.
It may be a keyboard driver, so Windows knows the F keys are there.
You would think that I'm pretty sure Windows knows Toshiba makes laptops.
Oh, yeah.
Because I believe that same exact model that you're talking about. So, yeah.
Well, the other problem is you're probably only one of the few people that ever use F keys anyway.
Well, that's true.
So I could see Windows 8 not supporting F keys because hardly anyone uses them anymore. Yeah, but for those of you that do,
I use them all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it does tend to be more of a power user function.
Right.
But they're useful once you learn them. That was the whole point of the graphical interface, is you don't have to memorize keys. But
with the laptop, you're always hitting the touchpad with your palm. And,
yep.
So it's nice just to be able to hotkey the touchpad off.
Yeah.
But so anything off the top of your head? I mean, well, first of all, it's just using a hard shutdown on Windows 8. Is that okay, or am I going to end up with a big pile of mess in the...
Well, you should always use the shutdown command. If it doesn't work from the keyboard, then you have to use the menu command.
Well, when
it
you
work. It just won't do it. It just sits there and.
How long do you wait?
Quite a while. I just hit the shutdown. It says, you know, the menu comes up in Metro, which I'm not a big fan of, but it comes up and it just sits there and looks at me like I'm stupid, and then just goes back about its business. You know, just will not shut down with our software.
Oh, interesting. All right. Yeah. The other problem first, however. Check your BIOS.
Okay.
You can turn off the function keys in some BIOS CCCs.
BIOS.
So check that first. Before you get nuts, it may just be off in the BIOS.
Oh, I'll have to look for that. Okay, that's good. Yeah, I couldn't find any resources. Usually that stuff's pretty prominent on the net, but I couldn't find any help for it.
It depends on what you search for. Sometimes, yeah, if you search for too much, you won't find it.
There you go. Yeah, for sure. All right, guys, well, that's cool. Well, I appreciate it. Now, we'll see what happens. But even if I don't resolve the problem with the software shutdown, does Windows 8 do housekeeping shutdown?
Well, yes, it does. It depends. You may have somewhere in your boot exec.
Right.
You may have shutdown. You may have auto check on for your drives, and so it won't do anything until it has done that auto check.
All right. Yeah, I've not seen any hard drive activity on the white, which does function. I don't see any activity when I do it. It just will not shut down with the software.
That's right. Weird. It might point to something more going wrong behind the scenes.
Could be, maybe.
Yeah,
okay,
it certainly could be.
I didn't pay much for this laptop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Or just leave it on all the time.
Yeah, well, I do, pretty much, but, yeah, you know.
Right.
Yeah, Windows usually crashes and forces you to restart it, rather than shutting it down to restart it.
Okay. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Sure. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
He's gone now. Sorry if you're still listening, which you should be. Some laptops have an FN key on it that you have to push to make the function keys work.
Oh, that's true, too.
It's like on my laptop, you know, if I hit F3, that actually raises the brightness. I have to use the function key, F3, to actually do the F3.
I know on my Toshiba that F8 works independently of the other keys because that's the network reboot key.
Right.
For the system reboot key. I don't know about the rest of the keys, but I know F8 is the system reboot key. And that one works independently of all the other ones, at least on the Toshibas they do.
Right. There's also a... Windows 8 has a hybrid shutdown feature. It basically hibernates the kernel session instead of closing it down so that it'll start up faster the next time. The problem is if that laptop doesn't support that, it'll always be a problem. So on the new start screen... in the search area, in settings, you know, there's a search bar right under there. Type power. And when you do that, select change what the power buttons do. And then that opens up the power options window. In there, You uncheck fast startup, and that should do it.
So it's a new software feature that Windows is assuming that the computer may not have.
Right.
Especially since Windows 8 wasn't bundled on the computer.
Right.
That can often be a problem. Some companies will make really specific hardware that only work with their specific install of Windows.
Yep. And Steve's going to put this on the system, so we'll see that shortly.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rule.
So we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Sound Bites on the truly great and truly
member-supported
Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites.
You got to make your clock bigger.
I do have to make my clock bigger. I do. I just need to get better eyes. I'm not sure which that's going to be. Our next caller is Dennis from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Dennis. What's up?
Well, I've called recently because I just went from a smartphone or a dumb phone to a smartphone. I'm an old guy, and it's an iPhone. So the question is for Steve. I'm trying to set up my email on the iPhone 4S. And what got me to thinking was you were talking about POP3 versus IMAP, I think.
Yeah.
And so here's the way I'm working things. I have Frontier DSL. I get my, I do my outgoing mail through Frontier, but I never use their portal or Yahoo or anything, because I use bluefrog.com, which used to be a dial-up service. It's a local local guy started it here in Rochester. And because I have so many people that have my Blue Frog address, I never...
Yep.
I don't have dial-up. I just use their...
Their email, yeah.
Their email.
Yep.
So now Frontier tells me they're POP3. I mean, do I need to...
Well, that's POP is receiving email, so you're not receiving email from Frontier unless you're using your Frontier address also. So when you signed up for Frontier Internet, you also got a Frontier email address.
Yes, but I never used it.
Yeah, you can just ignore that.
Yes.
So you're receiving mail server from Blue Frog. If they support IMAP, that's what you want to use.
Okay.
And there's actually a trick for Frontier now. Frontier does support IMAP, but it's kind of tricky. Frontier is using Yahoo for mail now as their back-end mail provider.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tell the iPhone it's a Yahoo mail account and then just put in your Frontier credentials, it will use IMAP.
Oh.
But if you tell it it's an other, which is sort of the catch-all for anything else, and put in your Frontier credentials, it will use POP. But in your case, you would say other and put in your Blue Frog credentials. I'm trying to find on their webpage if they support IMAP. Most services always support POP because that's sort of the older internet standard. But you often have to dig around a little bit to see if they also support IMAP. Because basically IMAP means all the mail stays on their computer, which makes it easy for you to check it with your multiple devices. But it means they have to have bigger computers and more hard drive space at the mail provider, and that's why some of them don't do IMAP.
So I would set up, I would choose Yahoo and then just use IMAP instead of POP3.
For your Yahoo mail.
With my Yahoo.
And your Frontier mail.
But I don't, I only send through Frontier, I don't receive through Frontier. Do I have to figure out whether bluefrog.com is POP3 or IMAP?
Yes.
Okay, and if it is not, then I've got to put POP3 in where it requests what type of...
Right, for the receiving mail server.
I see.
Now, many mail providers, the Apple Mail setup will know about. So they know about Frontier and Time Warner locally. I don't know if it knows about Blue Frog and will automatically enter the server addresses in for it. So you may have to call them to get those server addresses.
Okay. That's great. You've helped me out a lot. Thank you very much.
Sure.
There we go. Again, it's multiple systems, multiple settings.
Yep. It does say on their premium email they do POP or IMAP, but I'm not sure if they do IMAP on their free service. That was one of the differentiations in Yahoo for a while. The free Yahoo Mail was POP only, and if you paid for Yahoo Premium, then you could do IMAP.
Right.
They have since discontinued that, so IMAP is now free as well. I think a lot because Apple's is supporting Yahoo in the iPhones, so people can get a free Yahoo IMAP address on their iPhones.
Right. And I do like the fact that with something like Gmail, you can forward all those POP accounts to Gmail and then have them as IMAP so you can get them on all of your various things.
Yep.
But I think the day of POP needs to go away. But, you know, the companies love it because with POP, they get to say, we don't have to keep your email on our server.
Yep.
So if you lose it, it's your problem. We don't have to have that much disk space. So for them, it's a very good idea. That's okay.
What's good for the company is not necessarily good for the customer.
Yeah, exactly.
It used to be the other way around.
And you think that matters?
Yeah, well, it used to be, you know, what, the old adage, the customer's always right? Well, that hasn't been true in a long time.
Yeah. I always tell people at market, we have a coffee stand at the market, and when people come for a delicious cup of Saturday morning blend at the Flower City Coffee Company, if they have a question or whatever, I will say,
that was a blatant plug.
No, it wasn't. But it was, what I will often say to them is, well, as you know, the customer's often right.
Yep.
Stop for a second and go, wait a minute. I said, believe me.
I think your coffee should be free today.
Yeah, right.
No, you are not always right.
And then as you move up, the customer is occasionally right and the customer may be right.
Yeah, right. The customer, right.
Yeah.
All right. The trouble mobile phone maker BlackBerry still has at least one very loyal customer, President Barack Obama. At a meeting with youth on Wednesday to promote his landmark health care law, Obama said he is not allowed to have Apple's smartphone, the iPhone, for security reasons, though he still uses Apple's tablet computer, the iPad, which is essentially an iPhone without a phone in it. Apple was one of several tech companies that may have allowed the National Security Agency direct access to servers containing customer data, according to revelations by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. The company denies the allegations. Obama fought to keep his BlackBerry after coming to the White House in 2009, though he said only 10 people have his personal email address. Neither George W. Bush nor Bill Clinton used email during their presidencies. BlackBerry, a Canadian company, formerly known as Research in Motion Limited, virtually invented the idea of on-the-go mail, but lost its market stranglehold as rivals brought out more consumer-friendly devices like Apple's iPhones and phones using Google's Android software. The company recently halted plans to be sold and is trying to chart a new course by focusing on large business and government clients. So do you think your smartphone is secure? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
I have never seen a company as fickle as RIM. We're going to sell ourselves. No, we're not. We have a new phone. No, we don't. It's great. No, it's not.
We're going to have co-presidents, and they're both idiots.
And they're both idiots. But now they've done one smart thing. BBM is now available as an app.
Right.
The BlackBerry Messenger, which is the one thing everybody really loved about BlackBerry, is now available for iPhone and Android. The problem with it is that now it's at the point where nobody really has BlackBerries anymore. So
they're still real big in government, because one of the things, especially with the U.S. government, is the presidential communication is public record, in essence.
Right.
It ends up in the presidential library. So every email the president sends has to get archived for the library. And with the BlackBerry mail servers, they can intercept all of that mail. In fact, there was a revelation a couple years ago, might have been when Barack was first elected, that all of BlackBerry mail goes through their servers in Toronto, Canada.
Yeah.
So the irony that the entire U.S. government is pretty much run on BlackBerry phones and all of their mail goes through Canada.
Yeah.
A friendly neighbor, but...
But still not us.
Yeah. And
well, they can run their own BlackBerry server.
Which they probably do now.
The Bez server. BlackBerry Enterprise server.
Yep.
So I suppose Bez server is redundant.
Yeah. there have been cases in other countries where BlackBerries have been banned by repressive countries until BlackBerry opens the back door and lets the government read everybody's mail and messages.
Right.
And that's usually by putting a server in that country for them.
Right.
So that's what we're doing here with our president. We want to read all his mail.
That's right. All right, Ben, I think we got time for one last phone call this hour. George from Greece, New York. Welcome, George. What's up?
I need help on two things. Going to do a quick one first.
Yeah.
When you out to buy a new, say, a laptop, and looking at the little module that's going to receive the Wi-Fi, are there different standards or different quality levels offered by the various manufacturers?
Yes. The wonderful thing about standards is there's so many of them to choose from. I mentioned a little earlier.
So I'll give you the next sentence there.
Yeah. The current Wi-Fi standard is 802.11ac, and that's sort of the brand newest standard. It's only been around a few months.
Yeah, there's A, B, C, G, and N.
Yeah. And the letters in between we skipped.
We skipped.
So there was MNOP, and then AA, AB. Now we're on AC. We're hearing a lot of talk about the new AD coming, but currently
AC. And basically that means you have two separate antennas, two separate radios in it, an A antenna and a C antenna.
I see.
And so generally speaking, pretty much everything you buy today will have at least N. And some of the brand new or higher-end models will also have AC. AC has a neat feature in it called beaming. Normally, with your Wi-Fi base station, it just generates a sphere of radio, like a typical radio antenna.
Yes.
With AC, it can form a tight beam between the base station and your computer, so you get higher performance and longer range. AC is theoretically capable of 1.3 gigabits.
Right.
And N is limited to 0.4.
So what you really have to know is, as long as at least one of the letters on your router match one of the letters on your laptop, you can connect.
I see. Okay. And my primary concern is to get a little better distance or better performance within the range within my house.
Right.
Well, let's handle that after the break, if you want to hang on the air.
Can I hang on?
Yeah, hang on. It'll be a few minutes, but we're going to take a quick break. Well, somewhat longer break.
That's okay.
And testing George's patience. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, George from Greece, New York, and you. It is 55 minutes after the hour. And you've wasted an entire hour of your life, but you get a chance to do it again, because we'll be back with a whole lot more of Sound Bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
On Computer Show, Sound Bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 58 minutes after the hour, now I can see it big. We are Sound Bites. What I have is a fairly large machine with a very high resolution. So the letters are very tiny and my eyes are old. I'm good. My eyes are old. So I'm running an extension on Chrome called Currently. And when you open up a new tab, instead of seeing all of your extensions, what you see is the date and the time and the weather. And then, of course, there's a little button that you can hit to see your extensions. And so now I have inch-high letters telling me it's 12:59:26. So that's not bad. All right. This one is...
George is still on the line.
Oh, that's right. George is waiting patiently for me to forget about him. Welcome back, George.
I'm here.
There you are. So you want better distance on your wireless signal. How far do you get now?
I'm sorry?
How far do you get now?
Oh, it seems to vary with time, but I would say I'm probably in the order of 30 to 40 feet.
And what standard of Wi-Fi does your router have in it now?
Well, that's a good question. I was just looking at it. Now, I have one from Frontier, and I was looking at the name tag here. I don't see anything that seems to give away the secret.
It may not.
Is there a place that I could go look that up?
Or? Well, what's the model number, and we can Google it.
So it says model 7550.
Is that a Cisco?
Well, this one doesn't say it's... Oh, it's a Netgear.
Netgear. So basically, each version... If I can spell Netgear and talk at the same time. Each version of the Wi-Fi standard has gotten longer and longer range. So yeah. N was better than G. AC is better than N. Technical specs. Wireless N. So that does do N. So... Getting an AC router would give you longer range over the N router. Also, some routers can be higher power than other routers. So the more power in the radio signal, the farther the distance.
Good, Steve. That's the direction I think I want to go in.
Yeah.
Because there's certain times that I can work over this distance, and it seems to be fine.
What can happen is it is a radio, so it's subject to interference. And also to the construction of the walls in your house.
But that would be a constant for me.
Pretty much, but what we have seen occasionally is if the kitchen is between you and the router,
yes,
then the metal appliances will block the signal a little bit.
Good point.
And if someone turns the microwave on, that's 2.4 gigahertz.
The microwave interferes a lot of things.
Yep.
I understand that.
If you happen to have portable phones that use 2.4 gigahertz, that can be a problem also.
Okay.
So one of the things that, well, N does 2.4 and 5 gigahertz, so you can switch networks. So if your computer can also do 5 gigahertz. But 5 gigahertz doesn't penetrate stone as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the current AC standard is 5 gigahertz. The AD standard will be 2.4 and 5 gigahertz in the next couple of years. So that's what's nice about each new router also supports all the old standards too, so it'll mix and match with the older stuff. But yeah, the later wireless standards do better distance, and sometimes you may need to put a repeater or a booster, kind of like halfway between where the router is and where you want to use it.
I may need to do that. Now you touched upon older and newer. I was more curious to know if a more expensive model might have a better receiving unit than a less expensive.
Generally, yes, but not necessarily.
Okay.
You want to look at the power to the radio, how many watts the radio is, and how many antennas it has. Most of the N routers and the ACs now have multiple antennas. If you remember the olden days, you know, the B's and the G's routers, they'd actually had little antennas that stuck up and you could kind of aim them.
Yes.
Well, now the routers, all the antennas are all inside the box, so they don't break off primarily. But many routers have 6 or 8 antenna for the different frequencies and the different standards, so that you can get a better range out of them as well.
Okay.
There also are products called range extenders.
Right. And that may be what I need to get in order to get the reliability that I'm after.
Right.
I was most interested in, I'm going to buy a new computer, and I was curious to know if I should be asking about this particular performance, because it isn't something that's listed on the standard tag of information.
Right, but it won't be a function of the laptop. It will mostly be a function of the router.
Yes, okay.
However, of course, I suppose getting back to the router from the laptop
right.
will be a function.
Sure. Especially the metal laptops. Metal blocks the radio signal. So even on, like, the aluminum MacBooks, the what we call the clutch cover that covers the hinges for the screen and against the computer, that's plastic, and that's where your Wi-Fi antenna is.
Oh.
So depending on, you can sometimes change the orientation of your computer, which changes the antenna position, which gives you different signal strength.
Okay, this is good information. Can I go back to last week when you're talking about scanners?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get a chance to call in on this, but I heard some good discussion that was helpful. And I've been doing a little research. I'm interested in what I'll call a document scanner as opposed to a photo scanner.
Mm-hmm.
And I find several manufacturers like Epson, Xerox, Brothers. There's one I see called Viewpoint. I don't recognize that. Is that by chance a product made by another brand name, or is that one that's got a specialty?
I'm not familiar with that one either. The two big document scanners I'm familiar with are the Fuji Scan and the Neat scanner. The Neat scanner is designed primarily for receipts, so yes. You can scan your receipts and not keep the paper receipts. But I've had a lot of customers use the Fuji scanner. Snap Scan.
Is that the brand name SnapScan?
Yes, made by Fujitsu. Okay. And one of the neat things about it is it can scan both sides of the paper at the same time.
Oh.
So it only has to feed it through once.
Now, let me go a little step further with what I want to try to do with it. I'm a great one to collect newspaper articles, but after a while, my physical collection goes beyond what I can ever retrieve from. And I'm saying, why don't I take time to just make a scan of that and then develop some system like with... one node or one of those programs to try to catalog it. How many dots per inch do I probably need if I want to handle things like newsprint?
300.
300 would do it?
Yeah. And since there's a special issue with newsprint because it's flimsier than regular 20-pound paper,
You
may not be able to use a feeder.
Yes.
Or you may have to tape it to a feeder. So
viewpoint,
if you can get one with a flatbed and a feeder, then you get both sides.
Viewpoint also makes a handheld wand.
Oh, they do. I was looking for that, and I couldn't find even a trace.
Hold on a second. There's two viewpoints. Okay. There's V-I-E-W point and V-U point.
So I got the V-U point on my list. What was the other one?
V-I-E-W, view as a word as opposed to a cute couple of letters.
And is it the V-I-E-W is the one that has the wand?
No. Viewpoint, V-U point, has something called the Magic Wand Portable Scanner.
Oh.
I know it's available at Amazon. I don't know where else it might be available. ViewpointSolutions.com, and again, that's V-U point.
Yes.
ViewpointSolutions.com.
There's some very neat little designs of portable scanners these days. It looks like it's come a long ways.
Yeah.
Oh, and neat. They have a... what they call their Magic Wand plus an auto feed dock. So the wand, your paper stays still and you move the wand over it.
Yes.
You set the wand in the dock, and then the dock will feed the thicker paper through and use the same scanner head. So the dock has the feed motor on it, and the wand has the scanner head on it.
Okay.
That's kind of neat.
That is kind of neat. So you can use it both to do something like newspapers, which is too flimsy to feed through the feeder, and too big. And then if you wanted to feed 8x10 paper, then you've can just do it right through the feeder.
I'd like to look for that. What do you know the approximate cost of the wand?
The wand is somewhere between $60 and $80.
Is that right?
$100, I guess, depending on where you buy it. Right.
Last question here. Where do we stand these days with software that will interpret it and convert it to what I'll call computerized text?
Well, every OCR program, optical character recognition program, says they're 99% accurate.
And most scanners come with an OCR program.
Right.
They do.
So the problem with that is that's just over a line of text.
So one character out of 100 is wrong.
Right.
I can live with that.
Well, but the point is, if you've turned it all into text, then it's pretty easy to go through with a word...
Spell checker.
Yes.
Thank you. Clearly, I did not get enough sleep last night. A spell checker and deal with that. If you do columns of numbers, which these will also do, you've got a real problem. You have to check every single one.
Yeah, I wouldn't be so interested in that. But I want to take you then to the Xerox. At one time, they were into the optical character recognition. Is that still a product line that they offer?
Xerox Text Bridge. No, not really.
They're out of that.
Yeah.
I thought they were. So there's
most
no
all of
their Xerox mobile scanner would have any particular edge.
Well, they might still include it with their scanner, but I haven't seen their standalone software in quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Most all of the OCR software got purchased by Nuance, and Nuance has their PaperPort product, which is a document management system. So you scan into PaperPort, it OCRs it, and it's a database of your scans for you. Or the other one is the Read Iris, is the common OCR software that comes with scanners.
Uh-huh.
And then OmniScan is probably the granddaddy of scanners, but that's like $500 for just the OCR software.
Okay. Say, I appreciate this very much.
Sure.
Let me sure. get off the line so some others can get on.
All right, thanks. But yeah, give that a shot. See
Thank
what you
very
think.
Much. I'll yep. report back.
Yep.
But we're seeing this quite frequently now. No, it is OmniPage is the OCR software. But we're seeing it a lot, and we're seeing companies like Neat with their Neat Receipt Scanner doing a lot of television advertising. So you scan all your paper receipts, and it organizes it, it files it, and then it prints a report for your accountant, so you don't have to keep all these receipts in your shoeboxes that that your
Google
accountant
Goggles
loves so much.
Is supposed to do that as well. Google Goggles, one of the Google things, yeah. you take a picture of like a credit card. Not a credit card. Well, you probably could do that too somehow. But a business card.
Don't give people ideas.
Yeah, no
just
kidding.
Just, you take a picture, don't do it.
Right. Take a picture of a business card and it turns it into a contact
yep.
in your phone. So that's kind of cool too. Viewpoint, Viewpoint Magic Wand Portable Scanner also has a bunch of stuff on YouTube if you want to take a quick look at how it works before you go getting it yourself. But it's a pretty cool little deal. The ability for those of us who still use paper, paperless society, man, that's where we're supposed to be. Yep. For those who still use paper, then having a scanner like that to move those data into your there was a time before the internet, which most of you don't remember, where scanners were super important. Most of the computer magazines had some sort of barcode for all of the programs they had, and then they sold a scanner. The most popular one was called the QCAT, C-U-E-C-A-T, and you would then just, it was a wand computer, and you would wand over the barcode, and it would take the thing into your computer. Nice. So it was pretty cool.
Well, so do you remember the ThunderScan?
I loved the ThunderScan.
Back in the early days when we had impact printers and the little head moved back and forth, somebody figured out, and it was
Andy Hertzfeld
from Apple, that if you replace the print ribbon, do you remember print ribbons?
Yeah.
you replace the print ribbon with a scanner head, then you feed paper into your printer, and it scans it into the computer. So it turned your printer into a reverse printer.
Right.
So the little head moved back and forth, scanning your lines.
The mechanism is identical between scanning and printing. You move a head back and forth across the page from top to bottom.
And the pins either hit a ribbon to put ink on the paper, or a scanner head reads the ink that's already on the paper back into the computer.
Right. And so all he had to do was replace that print head. So it was if you already had an image writer, it was a very inexpensive scanner.
Well, back when scanners were 10 grand.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then this one was a few hundred bucks, and you thought, that's ridiculously cheap. Yep. And it worked great, by the way. Very nice.
Especially because all the printers back then were just black and white impact printers, so that's all you were scanning.
Right. Yeah. You're right. There was nothing fancy at that point. I think it did pictures. I think it did black and white pictures.
Yep.
Yeah. It was very, very cool. And I want to say there was a HyperCard extension.
Probably.
For it. And I didn't call them extensions back then, but there was a HyperCard thing for it. Stack for it. And you could create a form in HyperCard so that if someone filled out a form, you could get it. It didn't do handwriting well, but it did other stuff. Okay. Our next caller is from Greece, but I don't have a name. What's your name?
Name is Lee.
Lee?
Yes.
Okay, Lee, what's up?
Mike, I'm curious. Can you tell me, I have a router and at the moment I'm broadcasting my SSID. What are the pros and cons of that?
Well, almost every router broadcasts the SSID. That's not a huge issue. The issue is how you protect that router. So if you have WPA, that's not much protection anymore. WEP is not much protection anymore. But there are other formats. WPA is good. WPA2 is much better. So it's the way you protect it that's more important. Hiding the SSID is never a bad idea. It gives you that one extra little level of protection, but it's not the primary protection. The primary protection is the encryption method you use.
Yeah, so the SSID is the name of the network. So when you look for network, it says Steve's network. And so the primary advantage is it's easy for people to join your network because they can find that network, and then it will ask for the password. You can hide the network name so that people have to know the name before they can connect. And that will stop the most casual of users. But anyone with a little bit of knowledge will be able to find the name, even though it's not broadcast in the clear. The name is still getting broadcast by the router.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Enjoy the program.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, that's the big thing is a lot of routers only do WEP. And, of course, if you've still got a Windows, an XP machine, then you're pretty much stuck with WEP. But really, trust me, not a great way to protect anything.
It takes about what, 4 or 5 minutes to break a WEP password?
Well, if you're lazy.
Yeah.
And you're using your wristwatch. If you're using a computer, it's seconds.
I had a printer the other day. It was one of these weird problems that we had WPA on the network, but it was WPA TKIP.
Right, TKIP, yep.
And we had set up the router initially with WPA2 AES.
Right.
And the printer stopped working.
Yep.
And we had to downgrade the printer, or downgrade the router to WPA TKIP to let the printer connect again.
Yep.
It doesn't make any sense because it used to work with AES. Something changed in a firmware update somewhere.
Yes.
That it didn't like AES.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful thing about Sanders, so many to choose from. It's WPA2 AES is currently the best encryption to use, but older devices may not support it, so you have to downgrade your encryption. The Nintendo DS is notorious for only having WEP in it.
Right.
And so a few years ago, my son got one, and I had to downgrade my network so he could use the Nintendo.
Yep.
Nowadays, a lot of routers have a guest network that you can either put a weak password on it or no password at all for plausible deniability. And when guests come to your house, they can get on the internet without having any chance of accessing your stuff. The router separates those two networks. Because someone in your house just wants to check their mail or surf the web. They don't need your network. They just want the internet.
Right.
So you can do that for older devices that just need access to the internet.
And that's a polite thing to allow.
Yeah.
Open networks are a very bad idea. All you need is somebody parking in your driveway. Well, that goes back to talking about extensions for your wireless connectivity.
Yeah, it's a radio. You know, nominally it runs like 300 feet.
Right.
So it'll go through your walls into your neighbor. So you might be able to see your neighbor's network name when you look on your list. That means your neighbor can probably see yours,
when
too.
Yeah, when I look on mine, I can see the network from across the street, the network from downstairs, and the network from next door all at the same time.
Yeah,
and two of them I can get onto.
Right. Well, my wife is always complaining because when she loves to listen to Pandora while she's doing stuff out in the yard. In the front yard, she has no trouble getting all the way to the street with the Wi-Fi signal. When she's in the backyard, there's a upstairs there's a large metal shelf that I'm really not going to move because I have nowhere else to put it.
Yeah.
Which means that if she gets out to the pond, she loses the signal.
Yep.
Well, you know what? Don't go to the pond.
Or pick up the backyard neighbor.
Or pick up a neighbor. Well, or I'm going to put an extension.
Yeah.
I think I'll put an extender in the back window so it'll blast it out. But she gets very upset. And you know, you go back there to rake and stuff. I mean, and you know, if we go back there to sit in the on the bench by the pond, we're not really thinking about the radio at that point.
Yep.
So. But and she's now she's out there doing gardening, prepping for winter things. Well, not now, she's done now, but you know what I mean. Or in the spring, she gets upset. I get out to the pond and I can't. Okay, well, you can't. Can you still see the house from there? That's a clue that you're not going to get a signal.
Yeah, we always talk about the range of the router. It's nominally rated for. About 300 feet, but that's line of sight, no interference.
Right.
You put a wall in the way, that'll cut it in half. You put two walls in the way, that could cut it in half twice. In fact, what we see a lot of problem with, especially cable, but even phone in DSL internet, is they run the line into your basement because that's where all your wires are. Well, your basement is surrounded by metal I-beams holding up the house, which blocks the radio signal.
Yep.
And so you don't want them to put your Wi-Fi router in the basement.
Right.
Because that doesn't work very well.
I have a friend who still holds the record distance for Wi-Fi. He put an antenna inside a Pringles can and went from one mountaintop to
another
mountaintop.
It's like 100 miles.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. But we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
For our show.
Hi, this is Tom Patrick. Please join me tonight for Artistry in Jazz from 6 until 8 p.m. right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Rich from Irondequoit on the line. Sorry, Rich, what's up?
Yesterday I ran the Security Tango, and as part of it, then I ran AVG. And now, when I hit on my AOL icon on the laptop screen, everything gets big as if I'm in safe mode, and I can't get to AOL. I did say AOL, didn't I?
Yeah.
Huh. And it's weird, and I can't retrieve AOL back. How do I can delete it. You know, I'll delete the thing and then try to become a member again, but how do I reach out and grab AOL if my terminology is not right? Forgive me.
Are you opening the AOL application or the AOL website?
The website, which works upstairs on the desktop, but if something I screw up.
So if you just open up a browser and go to AOL.com, does that work?
Yes.
And delete that shortcut and make a new one.
Yeah, that's the way to. I think
there's shortcut properties. You can say what window size and what zoom factor.
That's what I need to know. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
How do I create a shortcut on the screen for AOL once I've gotten the
what
site?
What browser are you using?
On Google or Chrome or whatever. And then once I'm there, how do I create that site on the screen?
In Chrome, is that your main browser?
Yes.
Generally, you just drag the little favicon. So next to the website address in your address bar, there's usually a little icon. Just drag that icon to your desktop, and that should make the shortcut for you.
The icon would represent AOL?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Right. Yeah, most websites have their corporate logo as a little icon next to the address name in the address bar.
And that, okay, well, that's easy enough. Thank you.
Yeah, just drag it to the desktop. You're on your way.
I got it. Bye. Thanks.
Yep.
All righty.
That works in most any browser.
Yeah, pretty much. Most any browser and most any operating system as well.
You can also go over the URL address and drag that to the desktop, and that'll normally do it too.
Right. The address bar itself, just drag the whole thing right over, and it gets it there. Perfect. All right, this one is for Steve, specifically for Steve. Work has begun on a new generation of USB that will break compatibility with existing connectors in order to improve ease of use and allow for thinner devices. The new connector, called Type-C, is in addition to the existing USB 3.1 specification and is expected to be finalized by the middle of 2014. There aren't any images, certainly no prototypes available yet, but Type-C will be around the size of a micro USB plug and, like Apple's Lightning connector, will finally be reversible.
Yep. So you don't have to try it three times to make it work right.
In other words, no more frustrating attempts to charge your phone with an upside down cable. In a press, because you know there's a first world problem. Oh, I had to change. I had to turn my.
But it is frustrating. You try it one way, it doesn't work. You try it the second way, it doesn't work. You have to try it the third way before it works.
Exactly. In a press release, USB 3.0 promoter group chairman Brad Saunders said the Type C will meet evolving design trends in terms of size and usability, while allowing for future scalability in charging and data transfer. Type-C will enable an entirely new super-thin class of devices, from phones to tablets to two-in-ones to laptops to desktops, said Alex Peleg of Intel. They have a pirate working for... Oh, not Pegleg, Peleg. This new industry standards-based thin connector delivers data, power, and video. It's the only connector one will need across all devices. Since Type-C is an entirely new connector, the USB 3.0 promo group will also have to include a specification for adapters and cables so that the countless USB chargers out there aren't immediately rendered obsolete. But the need for a new USB port is in many ways overdue, as recently highlighted by Apple's sleek Lightning connector and devices like the Galaxy Note 3 with its speedy but clumsy and oversized micro USB 3 port. So are you ready for a new USB standard? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
It looks like Triplet makes USB A and B reversible connectors already. It's two connectors stuck together, so you can plug it in either way.
Yeah, that's got to work badly.
Yeah.
But what if you're talking specifically about charging, I don't even know how useful that's going to be anymore, because now they're all bringing out non-connected chargers. You know, a little plate that you lay your phone down on and it recharges it that way.
And there's three standards for that different companies are using.
Right. But in terms of having a USB cable that will move, that will not only charge your device but also allow for audio and video and data at a high rate of speed, that's really kind of a nice thing.
Yep.
You know, I suppose they're trying to take over HDMI. But whatever you do, that means you now only have to have one connector in the phone, which makes the phone cheaper, and you only have to carry one cable with you, which means that there's less of a pain in the neck for that. So, yeah, I like the idea. I still want a charger that I can just lay the phone down and it's charging. I want one of those in my car, too.
There's enough EM broadcasting around us. We should just be able to stick an antenna up and charge everything.
Well, and I blame Edison.
Yep.
Tesla was doing it. You know, Tesla had it done. And
then Westinghouse, so that we could sell copper
blame
wire.
Blame Westinghouse really is who you want to blame, because he just wanted to sell copper wire.
It's not normally the individual people. It's normally the corporate people that cause those issues. Yeah. So
Westinghouse was, for those of you who don't know, Nikola Tesla invented the 20th century. He was building a broadcast power station at Wardenclyffe, New Jersey. And he got it halfway built when Westinghouse, who was funding the whole thing, really for pennies of, you know, in terms of the amount of money that man had, came to Tesla and said, "Now, how are we going to charge people for this again?" And Tesla said, "Well, we're not." Wardenclyffe and Westinghouse said, "Then I'm not going to fund it anymore." So they've torn it down, but there's a group that's now built or bought Wardenclyffe, and they're rebuilding it as a Tesla museum.
Yep. They just had a tree lighting ceremony, apparently. Today at 5 p.m. there's a tree lighting ceremony at Wardenclyffe.
Yep.
So they're going to light up. I guess the tower is now a giant Christmas tree.
I should have worn my shirt today. I am a member of the Science Center at Wardenclyffe. I was one of the people in their Kickstarter.
Yep.
I think it's a great idea. I think we've ignored Nikola Tesla long enough, and I think it's time.
Have you been to the Science Center and the Tesla music exhibit they have?
Yeah. Yep. They did that many, many years ago. And my friend Brad, God rest him, was Nikola Tesla. And I went to see him, and he was doing all this little hand stuff, little glass rods and thimbles on his fingers and all this stuff. And I kept watching, and I was fascinated, because Brad, without his glasses, blind as a bat. And yet he had gotten contacts, actually, very early. I mean, these were very early contacts.
I can just see where the story is going right now. I was
expecting him at any minute to just stick his hand in a light socket accidentally, you know, and he did fine. And now they're doing it again. And I have another friend who's doing that. Mark, my friend Mark, is doing that. So I'm very impressed. They do the whole Faraday business and the Tesla coils and all of that stuff. It's very, very cool. If you haven't been to the those of you who are in Rochester, if you haven't been to the Museum and Science Center, you really should go. It's very cool.
Yeah, they had a party, a science fiction party, a month or so ago, and people dressed up in costume and had science exhibits and the Tesla coils. We did a music trivia contest with science fiction theme songs.
Nice.
And I got 4 out of 5, but no one could get that last one to say, what in the world was that one?
And what was it? I
never found out.
What?
I gotta go back and find out what it was. A lot of people were stumped by Doctor Who, which annoyed me. Really annoyed me. What was number 5? What was the Doctor, of course?
How would you not know the Doctor Who theme song?
Yeah, we think not Flash Gordon. It was one of the other 30 serials was the one that we couldn't get.
Oh. There were a lot of those. Yep. But yeah, there's a station on not YouTube, Pandora. That's movie themes.
I was going to say there's a Tesla music coil station.
Wouldn't that be fun? I'll have to look and see if there is. That would be pretty cool, actually. But yeah, there's a. I do Pandora all the time myself. All right, our next caller is Mark. From enough of the nonsense with us, our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. Welcome, Mark. What's up?
Hi. How are you today?
Good. And you?
I'm good. I was wondering if any of you are watching the new series Dracula on NBC.
We started watching it, but then fell behind when the DVR got full.
So he's an entrepreneur trying to use wireless electricity.
Nice.
So they incorporated that into series. Well, I thought it was a
that's a ripoff of Sanctuary, because Tesla was a vampire on Sanctuary.
He was. I was just going to say the same thing. You know what? Broadcast power is a brilliant idea, but it comes right back down to how do you charge for it?
Well, and exactly. And we did the same thing with television. Television stations broadcast for free, and you can receive it for free. You just have to watch the commercials.
Right.
And
so how do you put a commercial into broadcast power?
Yeah, you turn the lights off every now and then. And
yeah. So they have to make some sort of proprietary receiver for it. That's how they make their money.
Yes.
Well, that's exactly right. You'll have to encrypt the power. I don't even know how you manage it.
Well, like in England, there's a license to buy a television, and that goes back to the broadcasters. But in England, when there's one broadcaster, a little harder here.
Right.
Right. I just thought it was a little neat little side note on your.
No, it's very cool
that they're using that, and on top of that, he's trying to find a way to walk around in daylight so he can go to his shareholders' meetings.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's Blade and Wesley Snipes, the Daywalker.
That's funny.
That's where Van Helsing comes into the picture, making up his formulas to be able to let him walk around in daylight.
Oh, instead of killing him, he's trying to cure him. That's interesting.
Exactly. Well, not cure him, just giving him an injectable serum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we're getting so much science fiction and science fantasy TV shows on TV lately. It's really interesting. Well, it kind of goes in cycles.
Right, and the problem, of course, is that no matter what you put out, whether it's science fiction or medical dramas or crime shows, you find that people are reusing plots because there's really aren't that many plots.
Yeah. I just finished watching a New Zealand series called The Almighty Johnsons about living incarnations of Norse gods. I was watching it on the internet, and then I read that Sci-Fi Channel bought that and is going to start airing it next year.
Oh, good.
Oh, very cool.
Yep.
I'm very excited, speaking of television shows. The Sing-Off is coming back, starts Monday.
Yep.
There is nothing to me more beautiful than the human voice in close harmony. And this is an a cappella Sing-Off reality.
That's one of the most unique singing shows that there is. It's not like any of the others, so it is more enjoyable, I think, than the rest of them.
Yeah, I agree with you. The rest of them, everybody sounds exactly the same because they're all going for exactly the same sound.
Yeah, who's playing vocal acrobatics is usually what's going on. You
right,
know?
They're not. It's not about singing; it's about screaming.
Yeah,
I don't get off my lawn while you're at it. But yeah, I don't go for it. For most of those, they're kind of like, who cares?
But yeah, getting back to that, yes, you're right. They are reusing a lot of different things. So I thought when they brought in Dracula, I'm going, oh boy, you know, is this just going to be another rehash? And they're totally turning it on its ear.
I'll have to make sure
I thought
catch
that was a very, very unique way of doing it, and I'm growing to like it more and more.
Very interesting.
A little bit like Sherlock with Watson's a girl. What's her name?
Elementary.
Yeah,
Elementary, yeah, Lucy Liu. Yeah.
I have to brag.
No one ever heard of Sherlock Holmes in that universe.
Right, I have to brag. I'm on Google+, and the other day this guy followed me, and I was about, there are 100 people who want to follow you because, you know, I don't know who they are. And so I was about to just not respond. And it turned out to, and I looked at the name. I said, Bob Goodman, I know this name. I know this name. So I looked him up, and then I had to look him up on IMDb to prove he's really who he says he is. He's the writer and producer for both Elementary and Warehouse 13.
Ah.
And he's following me. So I'm just bragging. I don't know why he's following me. God bless him. I'm glad he is. Probably,
I'm sure you're flattered.
Probably a mistake. But
so that's what's wrong with the studio computer.
So that was kind of my moment of bragging right there. Yeah. That's
well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Mark. We appreciate
it. Have a good
day. You too.
Bye-bye.
You'll notice sometimes we don't talk about computers. Sometimes we talk about television shows.
Which are run by computers.
Which are run by computers these days. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on the truly great and truly member supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have David from Leroy on the line. Welcome, David. What's up?
Thank you. I wanted to agree with you guys on the beauty of a cappella singing.
Thank you.
Yeah, I sing in the Warsaw Barbershop Chorus, both as a chorus member and in a quartet. It's just wonderful and very fulfilling.
Yep. And my one single regret in life is that I'm not a bass.
Well, neither am I. So. I sing the tenor part in the quartet and the lead, which is the melody, in the chorus. So it's really fun. But I do have a quick question for you.
All right.
I recently upgraded on my Mac Mini to Mavericks 10.9, and I'm using the Safari browser version 7. That's the most current version. But for some reason, if I go to any website that has a video, I can't see the video. Now, I did some checking on this, and supposedly this version of Safari supports, it has kind of a built-in Flash player in the software itself. So I am running the latest version of the Flash player independently as well, and I still get no video.
As far as I knew, there was no Flash in Safari, and they specifically removed it. But let me check. But having the Adobe Flash player in it should work. What Safari will do is not display Flash as a power saving and processor saving issue, but there's usually a little button that says show Flash or play the Flash.
You mean in the preferences?
No, in the window where the video should be.
Oh, I see.
What do you get instead?
Just the art, the text, and a blank white area where the video should be.
You may have to go into your preferences and allow Flash.
I see.
If your Flash is too old, and this is true of Safari on all platforms, if your Flash is too old, Apple will block it if it's known vulnerable. And you should get a message that you need to update your Flash.
Which I have gotten that, but it conflicted with what I had read about Safari having support. So I will do that again.
Also, under Safari Preferences Security, make sure the plugins are enabled.
Yes.
Yeah, your plugins enabled, and then you can authorize which websites you want to be able to access what plugins. So you could say YouTube, you can allow Flash, but for any random website you happen across, you might want to disable Flash until you tell it it's okay.
Got you.
Also,
okay, well, that should solve my problem.
Well, also under System Preferences, under Flash Player, under Storage, make sure it doesn't say block all sites from storing information in this computer.
Okay, System Preferences.
Yeah, one of the choices there is Ask Me. And then, you can say yay or nay to each individual site. And then once you've done that, it will remember that site. So, for example, if you always go to news sites that play video,
right,
that personally makes me even more crazy than I am. But some
people
like it.
And it's three tabs ago, and you can't find out which tab just started playing.
They're saying the next version of Chrome, and I cannot wait, will actually have a little speaker on the tab that's playing sound.
So you can see which one it is.
So you can see, you can easily find which one it is.
Oh, yeah, that is nice, yeah.
I'm waiting for that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still navigating through Mavericks. It's very different as far as its accessibility. So.
Yep.
Yeah, they like to change things because they think it's better, but they thought it was better the other way last time.
Yeah, I really don't like the new tags. It's a backward step. I wish they'd replenish the old labels.
Yeah, what I've done on mine is I just ignore the word tag and in my mind substitute the word label, and I still use it as a label.
Yeah, but
you get a dot color instead of colorizing the whole line, yeah.
Being a visual person, I like the whole line. But thank you for all your help, guys.
Sure.
Thank you.
Have a Merry Christmas.
You too.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Yep. Yeah, the big thing with Flash and Mavericks is that Flash is now sandboxed so that a malicious attack in Flash in one tab won't leak into the other tabs. One of the problems that Flash runs into is that it has to be updated so often because the bad guys keep finding problems with it and exploiting holes. And so by having it sandboxed, if an exploit gets into one tab, it can't affect your other tabs. So say you have your mail open in one tab and you're watching kitten videos in the other tab, it can't leak over into the mail tab and access your email. So
right.
That's the good thing about sandboxing Flash.
Right. But it does, well, yeah, it's very good. All right. Jeff Bezos is nothing if not a showman. Amazon CEO loves a good reveal and took the opportunity afforded by a 60-minute segment to show off his company's latest creation, drones that can deliver packages up to 5 pounds to your house in less than half an hour. They're technically octocopters as part of a program called Amazon Prime Air. A drone sits at the end of a conveyor belt waiting to pick up a package. Bezos says 86% of Amazon's packages are under 5 pounds and can carry them up to 10 miles from the fulfillment center. As soon as Amazon can work out the regulations with the FCC and figure out how to prevent your packages from being dropped on your head, Bezos promises there will be a fleet of shipping drones taking the sky. The segment focused primarily on holiday shopping, particularly the annual shopping extravaganza that is Cyber Monday. It's a huge day for Amazon. More than 300 items will be ordered each second and does much to reveal the company's true ambitions. Amazon doesn't just want to reinvent the way we shop for and buy things. It wants to upend every step of the process, including how our purchases come to us. Charlie Rose spoke to a number of Amazon executives and employees and toured one of the company's 96 massive warehouses known as fulfillment centers. Its burgeoning same-day delivery infrastructure was on full display, and Rose explored the company's sprawling moves into fashion, groceries, web hosting, tablets, and strange political shows starring John Goodman. But Jeff Bezos was predictably the star of the segment. He talked about how 18 years ago, he'd drive packages to the post office himself and dreamed of one day owning a forklift. Things have changed a bit since then. He says we're 4 or 5 years from drones being able to deliver small packages right to your house, largely because the company has to work with the FAA to make sure it's legally allowed to run the Prime Air program. Amazon doesn't have Zuckel's luxury of operating in Australia without the FAA's regulatory oversight. Bezos knows there's work to do, but his overwhelming message is simple. Get ready. It'll work, it'll happen, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Oh, and the UPS is researching delivery drones to compete with Amazon's Prime Air. So are you ready for drone deliveries? Do you have your shotgun primed and loaded? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Okay, when I first heard this story, I'm like, it has to be off the onion. it has to be a story that the media took seriously off the onion. And then I went into the story, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is real.
Yeah.
They're actually thinking about doing this.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
All right.
See, I've always wanted pneumatic tubes, but this is the next step up.
This is better. Of course, they've already, you know, you're already seeing cartoons of people shooting down the drones with shotguns and saying, oh, dang it, this is a recharge cable for a Nokia phone. Mine's Motorola.
Yeah.
But it's the future. You know, if you can automate that sort of thing, not good for people who drive the trucks, but if you can automate that sort of thing, it means lower cost, faster delivery, which is all what people want. So we're going to see it.
Yeah, but my issue with that is, how do you prevent interference? How do you prevent hackers from hacking into the system and taking it over? How do you prevent, you know, if we're being dropped in places where it shouldn't be dropped, how do you prevent all these issues? That's the main issue here, is how do you prevent all those issues?
Right, right. And if even if they, you know, right now, people worry about somebody taking their Amazon packages when it gets dropped on their doorstep, how much more of that will happen when the whole neighborhood sees the drone coming in for a landing?
You know, I'll have to have little helipads on your roof.
There you go. We'll all have skylights on our roof.
Yep.
Where we can open it up, reach up to the helipad, and take our package after it's been delivered by the drone.
Drop it here. Yeah. Drop it here.
Yep.
Thank you.
We'll all have big nets. Drop it here.
And a similar topic, I read this week that Chili's and Applebee's are going to start putting tablets on the tables.
Yep.
So you can place your orders from the tablet, and they can fire all the waiters and waitresses.
Well, and that's part of the issue,
but
of course.
There have been times when, you know, you need something and you're trying to wave the attention down.
Right.
But and we've seen restaurants are almost understaffing these days because of a cost. In fact, the whole mess with the fast food workers picketing in front of McDonald's.
Right.
Because it was supposed to be teenagers making some extra money. Besides,
now it's a living for people.
Right now, yeah, almost everyone they were interviewing was, you know, I'm the primary wage earner for my household. I've got, you know, a spouse and two children to cover on $7 an hour, and it's not working.
It's not going to work. And let me ask this question: have you ever gotten any piece of food anywhere that looked like the picture on the menu or in the commercial?
No.
No is the correct answer.
There's secrets to advertising.
Yeah.
What you see, if it's a hot food in the commercial, it's probably frozen cold and painted. And if it's supposed to be cold, then it's probably hot. Or what was the one I read about, you know, the nice golden turkey?
They showed a video in my class a few years ago where they actually showed somebody where they would open up the burger wide open and then put a cardboard piece of cardboard behind the thing and spread it open so the burger looked bigger than it actually was.
Yep.
And I found that, like, very interesting at that point.
What was that movie about truth in advertising? Drink our colon cleanse or you'll die of cancer.
Yeah, right. There's a friend of mine who was a spritzer for food. When you want vegetables to look good, you spritz them with a some form of liquid, but it's a kind of a gel.
Mm-hmm.
It's not water. And for years, that was her job with the ad agency she was with. All right, we're done for another week. I want to thank every single person who called in. I want to apologize to all those of you to whom we did not get, unfortunately. We only do this for 2 hours a week, and you need to call earlier and more often. So thank you all for listening in. I want to thank Steve Ray. Michael Oden, who did a great job on the buttons this week. Don't go away because George is coming in to do the absolute greatest German music you will hear all week. And we'll be back next week with a lot more sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.